Good morning and welcome back to Nach Yomi. Today we're going to be learning together Daniel Perek Hei, the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel. This chapter is 30 psukim long and the general topic of discussion is Belshazzar. Belshazzar the king, not Belshazzar as Daniel. We'll get there in just a moment. Let's look at it in a few sections. We're going to look at the story as it progresses. It's the fall of Belshazzar. So we're told the following. The first four psukim constitute our first section in which Belshazzar, the king, has a large wine feast and he commands to bring out the vessels from the ransacked Beis HaMikdash so he and his court and his family can drink from them. That's what they do. They bring out the golden vessels from the Beis HaMikdash and they drink from them pompously. And while they're doing so, they praise their pagan deities of their land. So they praise all these idols made out of all these different materials. Before we go further, just a few points to ponder. Who is Belshazzar? So we don't get any genealogy here in Tanakh. We're left to wonder. So Seder Olam, or Rabbah, which is the Midrash, which does a lot of the timing that Chazal Rashi works by, explains that Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 45 years. His son Evil Merodach reigned for 23 years. And his grandson Belshazzar, the son of Evil Merodach, reigned for 3 years. And that's who we're referring to. So it's the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Rashi has a little bit of a different way of looking at it based on the seeming discussions that have happened in our Perek, which seem to be expressed in the Psukim. Rashi suggests that, in fact, Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar, the brother of Evil Merodach. Okay. In terms of the actual annals that the Babylonians have set out, we know there are a few other kings which are mentioned. So Nebuchadnezzar II is the famous Nebuchadnezzar. After him, he has a son called Emil Marduk, which is Evil Merodach. Then there is Nergalissar and Labashi Marduk and Nabonidus. And Nabonidus is, of course, in exile for a few years, in which his son Belshazzar is the king. So it seems that Chazal are contracting a number of these kings into the figures that are relevant for for history. Nabonidus was the one who does have that period where, historically speaking at least, they talk about him being in exile and Belshazzar taking the throne, which does seem to match up with the prophecies discussed in the previous perek regarding Nebuchadnezzar, or whether there was a historical reattribution to a later king from the historical side is also a possibility. Why did Belshazzar in fact do this? What prompted him to crack out the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash? So the Malbim quotes Chazal, who say that he had done a cheshbon, that he knew that Yirmiyahu the prophet, the powerful prophet, had told that there would be 70 years before Babylon would fall, and 70 years had passed before Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and in fact the Babylonians were going strong. So therefore he pulled out a party almost to celebrate the overcoming of that terrible decree of Yirmiyahu from his perspective. The Malbim also quotes Josephus, who says that he was actually deep in war with Persia and the Medians right now, and because he had just achieved a great victory on the battlefield that day, he brought in all his officers to celebrate with him. Usually it would be more of a security issue. The king would not appear in such a large public forum, but he pulled in over 1,000 officers, it seems, to celebrate his victory on the field, which is what this night was as well. So it seems less Jew-specific. By the way, the Tanakh does not give us an explicit ending to Nebuchadnezzar. We just move from Nebuchadnezzar's, so to speak, humbling at the end of Perek Dalet, and now we're moving into Belshazzar, his progeny. So what actually happened, the Midrash Vayikra Rabbah in Perek Yudches tells us that, in fact, when Nebuchadnezzar was out, he put his son Emil Merodach on the throne. He assumed the position. When Nebuchadnezzar returned to his senses, he immediately imprisoned for a lifelong sentence his son. He was obviously a very power-hungry person and did not want his son taking his position. That being the case, he remained in prison until the point when Nebuchadnezzar actually died and his courtiers came to his son, Emil Marduk, and said to him that your father's dead. And he refused to set his foot out of the prison until he'd seen the evidence, and they said they exhumed the body of Nebuchadnezzar to bring it in front of him to show. And when that happened, all those people who hated him all took their swords out and penetrated the body of Nebuchadnezzar because he was such a angry, such a tyrant. And this seems to be the end of it. So it doesn't seem like there was any feelings of endearment which were harbored between father and son in this respect. So what happens? We return to our Pesukim. Pesukim Vav Dehei to Zion tell us a terrifying thing. As at the zenith of this feast they're having, they're drinking the wine, suddenly a hand appears. And the fingers of a hand appear and starts writing on the lime of the wall in front of the menorah, in front of the candelabra or the window, according to the Rav Sajid Gaon. The king sees this, and he sees actually the hand itself, and he starts collapsing, and it actually says his knees started knocking each other. He was in such terror, terrifying. They started hitting each other because he was trembling in such fear from seeing this supernatural experience. And he calls desperately to his magicians and his sorcerers to come and help him, and he promises any interpreter of those words on the wall, purple garments, a golden necklace, and he'd be one of his three senior viziers of the kingdom. But we go into Pesukim Ches and Tes, and no one is able to read it. All the wise men come together, can't read it. And this makes the king even more nervous, and his face begins to change. His face starts to lose color. Why can't they understand it? So it is interesting that the Malbim points out that whatever the reason was, Hashem doesn't want them to understand. A lot of times prophets might get visions, but they don't have interpretations. Yeah, they don't even have the vision. So Hashem's completely humiliating them. Why the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Achav Bezman, tells us three opinions or four opinions what was really going on over here. Rav says it was in the Atbash system, so it was switched letters. Aleph was switched with Taf, and they didn't know the coding. Shmuel says it was written, out of order. So the letters were scattered. It was written vertically according to the way it was, some interpret Shmuel. Rabbi Yochanan says it was written backwards. Or Rav Asi says maybe the first two letters of each word were reversed. So there's something which doesn't make sense. Now remember, this is a prophecy of four words. Four words written on the wall. And it was specifically designed in a way that could not be understood. Whose hand is this that they're actually seeing? The Chidah points out that it's the hand of Gavriel. The angel Gavriel appears a number of times in Sefer Daniel. And the Malbim points out that while it is true that the courtiers saw the fingers, then Belshazzar actually saw the actual hand. So it was supernatural in the sense that they were actually seeing similar things but different. And it was not graffiti. It wasn't somebody who scribbled king writing on the wall. They saw it as it happened on the wall in front of the light. So there's no shadows. This is clearly a supernatural experience they're witnessing. So at this point in time, the king's almost in a nervous breakdown. So from Sukkim Yud to Yud Beis, we're told that the queen enters the room and she walks in. She tells the king, you'll long live the king. Don't worry, there's a man who at the times of your father had the wisdom of Hashem with him, and his name was Daniel. They also called him Belshazzar, but we will call him Daniel. So one question just to ask is, who's the queen and how does she know this? So a lot of the Mefarshim go in the route that the queen refers not to the wife of Belshazzar, but the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, who's still alive, as Ibn Ezra says, and the Chidah points out that that's why she wasn't at the feast. She was an almana, she was a widow, and so she was not attend these kinds of large parties, which is why she's only walking in now, but she has that information of the past which he perhaps was not privy to. Why does she seem to call his name Daniel, which is his Hebrew name, rather than his Babylonian name? So it seems that Belshazzar is after the name of one of the gods in the Babylonian pantheon. And in order to give honor to their god, that's why Nebuchadnezzar named Daniel as such. But his son, he was also named the same, so it would not be respectful to have a courtier who's named the same as the king. Even though it's spelled slightly different, Balt or Belshazzar, nonetheless, it's too similar, so she said, let's call him Daniel. So it's almost a reversal of identity at this point in time. So this is what happens in Pesukim Yud Gimel to Tes Zion. He summons Daniel, he describes what he sees, and he knows that he comes from the exile of Yehuda, and he has great insight and wisdom from heaven. And he says that Daniel, please undo the knot, and he'll be duly rewarded. At which point, from Pesukim Yud Zion to Chav Gimel, it's a remarkable speech that Daniel presents in front of the king. He says, the reward you give to whoever you want. I'm going to explain the writing whether or not I get a reward. And then he tells Belshazzar that his father was the most powerful of kings. He would kill and let live whoever he wanted. He would lift up and throw down at will. And yet he was arrogant, and so he was taken out of his seat of power, and he became like a beast of the field, eating grass and drinking the dew of the sky, until he recognized that Hashem was the king, and at which point he was reinstated. And then he turns to Belshazzar and he says, but you, his son, are arrogant. You put yourself above heaven, and you sit with your family drinking out of the chalices of Hashem's Migdash, praising deities that are inanimate. The God who lets you breathe, you ignore. From him, this writing was sealed, and the words are Mene Mene Takil Uparishin. Those are the four words that he interprets, whether he's unjumbling the words or breaking the code. Whatever it is that he's able to do, he explains the words are Mene Mene Takil Uparishin. Now he goes on to explain what they are. From Sukkim Chavdalad to Lamed, he goes on to tell him what the interpretation of these words are. He says that the words are, you are be Hashem counted your kingdom, Mene, meaning Hashem is taking into account all the ins and outs of your kingdom. You are weighed and found lacking to Kale, and your kingdom will be spread out to the Persians, Peres. Mene Mene Tekel Uparis. And Belshazzar immediately goes and gives all the honor due to Daniel, gives him the clothes and the golden chain and so on. And the Perek ends off very eerily. Bob Elelya, on that night, Katil Belshazzar, Malka Kasdaya, the Chaldean king, the Babylonian king, Belshazzar was murdered that night. And the question then becomes, you know, this is murder in the Orient Palace. Who killed Belshazzar? So the Ibn Yahya, as the one of the commentators says, it was one of his servants. Rashi presents this as an option because perhaps this was a Macbeth drama in the sense that once the servant had heard the explanation of the dream, he took it upon himself to fulfill the prophecy, thereby killing Belshazzar, knowing that he was fulfilling the prophecy. That's one perspective. Rashi quotes Josephus in Antiquities, or Yosifun, which is a summary of that, who says that it was actually the Persians who made a night raid that evening, and remember, he just vanquished the Persians on the battlefield. They made a night raid and were able to murder Belshazzar right that night. What happened to the 70 years? Meaning, surely he was celebrating the fact that he was successful. So what happened to the 70 years disappear? So the truth is, there's two ways of measuring the time frame. Is it either from the time that Nebuchadnezzar rose to power, or from the time that he actually started battering Jerusalem, which was really a year or two later. If that's the case, then we really have an extra year. So Chazal point out that there's a year of Darius, who takes over, Darius the Mede, who takes over now, really belongs to the reign of Babylonia, according to this way. But it's, in a certain sense, it's a liquid prophecy that there's interpretation on both sides, because ultimately he was wrong. Belshazzar was wrong. It happens to be there's a third way of interpreting the 70 years, and we'll get to that when we get to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. In the meantime, this concludes Perek Hay. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.